I saw the fire in the weeds. And so we immediately called, my wife did, called the fire department. It's a volunteer organization from Fairdale that we belong to. And they said they were on their way already. They'd heard about the fire. And before they got there, the fire got there. And by the time they got there, well, their equipment was too small. And I had been piling junk in a valley that came up towards the house. I'm doing it on purpose so that I accumulate some wood, rotten wood and stuff like that. Very much interested in that. And when the fire hit that, it was like hitting a powder keg. And the heat was so intense, I got out a garden hose, and my garden hose wasn't in the woods, but it melted out beyond that, and the fire got to the house, and I had a overhead fan that brought in air through the west window and blew it out through the north window to cool off the attic in this log house. The log house is only one floor, and I didn't have sense enough to turn off that darn fan. I don't think it would have done any good anyhow, because my shop burned up also, and it didn't have anything like that. And so the fire, by the time the fire department got there, remember now, they were already started when I called them. And I got out this garden hose, but I couldn't use it, because by the time I got the hose hooked up, the fire was in that mess of wood that I had been piling up in that little valley about 15 feet from the house. And when it hit that, I had to run in order to escape from being burned up. My son, he was working for a Philly station at the time, and he hustled up there as soon as he heard about the fire. He heard the fire engines and called up, of course, and we told him. He came up and got our cars out, so they didn't get burned up. They got the cars out of the garage. And I had a tractor, and he got that out before the fire hit. But when that fire hit the house, the fire department just simply couldn't do anything. I mean, they tried. And they poured water on, but they didn't have enough water. And, of course, I didn't have water. I was using a cistern. The cistern went dry almost immediately after the fire department got there. And so the house was, my insurance company said it was complete. And they paid the full value of the insurance that we had on it. And I had just increased the insurance, about 2 months before. Fortunately, and we had money enough to build, rebuild the house, but I didn't have money enough to rebuild the shop.
I see.
And so I stayed away. I'd already retired now. I was on retirement at the time the fire hit us, about 1967, 68 maybe. And then another item which comes in on this, it has nothing to do with astronomy, but the physics department, prior to this, needed a man for the shop. And I had known about the man, Mr. Dietz, who is now still at the shop. I'd known about him, and I told Dr. Adams, who was then head of the department. He has since deceased. But I told him about Mr. Dietz, and so he got Mr. Dietz to come out for an interview. And I talked to Dietz, and Dietz said, I can't work for those people. I don't know enough. And I said, yes, you do. Your ability is what they want. They don't care whether you know what they're doing or not. And so I persuaded him to come out, and he got the job with the physics department, and they've been tickled pink ever since with this man, who was an excellent machinist, especially at handwork. And that influence, that comes up to me partly because 1 year after I retired, I think it was 1968 or 69, they physics department had more work than Mr. Dietz could do.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was looking around for something to do at my retirement, and I felt unable to reproduce my shop, which I was intending to use as a hobby, when I retired. And so I contacted the head of the department. I don't remember now whether it was Dr. Adams or someone else, but I contacted them, and sure enough, they had more work than Mr. Dietz could do. And so I offered to come and work in the shop half-time. And I'm very allergic to paying more to the federal government than necessary. And I discovered that if I worked at the shop and earned more than $1,680 at that time, it's gone up since, but at that time, if I earned more than $1,680, the government took half of what I earned out of the Social Security benefit that I was getting. And I couldn't see that paying out half of that, so I worked the first year. And this was, I was 72, so this must have been, I was 72 2 years after. I worked for 2 years at 1680. And then I passed my 72nd birthday, and then I could work as much as I pleased, earn as much as I pleased without having to pay it back to the federal government. So then the head of the department was a little bit cautious when I got to this stage. I'd been working for 1680, and I mentioned the figure that I'd be willing to work for, which was way below what they would have had to pay anybody else. I don't remember now what it was even, but it wasn't too awfully much. It was more than 1680, of course, more than twice, about almost twice as much. But they were tickled pink to get me for half time. By that time, they knew what I could do, and they were willing to keep me.
Let me ask you, did you ever get did you ever get the full prior service benefits?
I did finally, yes.
You did, okay.
That's when I complained bitterly to Strickler and Davidson, then when Strickler was president, they got the Board of Trustees. It wasn't done for me individually, no. It was done for the whole faculty who had retired previously. Got the same retirement benefit that the other people were getting. Mm-hmm. I got it then.
Yeah. The first time you came to the archives, before we actually did any interviews, you told me a funny story about having lunch with President Miller, and you didn't know who he was.
That's right.
Can you repeat that for the record?
President Miller had come over to the physics department and gave a lecture at the physics colloquium. I attended the lecture, and I should have known better, but I didn't. Then later, there was a man who we were having lunch in the lunchroom, and he was commenting something about what he wanted to do for the University of Louisville. I should have suspected. And after lunch, I asked one of my colleagues, I said, "Who is this man?" They looked at me startled. They said, "Well, that's Dr. Miller, the president of the university." I didn't know him. I've known him every time I met him since, but at that time, I missed out. That's purely an aside. But I was along with the other people in the university. I think most of the faculty had very little contact with Dr. Miller, really.
Is there the one other thing that that I was interested in was your trip to Brazil in 1947? I'm not
48.
48. I'm not sure that... did we ever cover that? Did we cover
that? I don't
think
so.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, in 1948, the professor at Brown University the professor of astronomy, Charles Miley. He had been a graduate student at Illinois at the same time I was. Only he was graduating in astronomy, and I was graduating in mathematics. And he worked for the astronomy department, did his research in that. And he had a fellowship to Norway, I think it was, and then from there he was invited to come to Brown and head the astronomy department at Brown University. But he was interested very much in Navy, especially in navigation. And at the time, in 1948, the data that they had for taking sun counts didn't go below 10 degrees of elevation of the sun above the horizon. Below that, they didn't have any information as to what to expect, because the atmosphere would distort the position of the sun, apparent position of the sun, and your sightings would be not too good if you got them. They just didn't have them. And so Smiley had a contract with the Navy to do research on the trip down to Brazil. And since we had been students together at the university and he knew about me, he invited me to go along with the party, providing I didn't ask for a salary and providing that I paid a little bit toward my expenses. So I took him up on it, and at that time, this was in the spring, in April, when we took off, I got permission from the university to skip half of that semester teaching for half of my salary. I only lost half of it as a result of going for half a semester. Now you can get a sabbatical for a semester. On full salary. But that was all that they would do at that time. This was in April 1948, not too long after the Depression. And they were a little bit cautious. Of, sabbaticals just weren't done here then. They were later put in, of course, as you know. Now it's a standard thing. Every 7 years the faculty gets a chance to go on sabbatical. But that was the one I had. And we... So I joined this organization then, Brown University Group. I went to Providence, Rhode Island, where Brown University is, and stayed at Professor Smiley's house until the ship that was going to take us to Brazil got ready to go down, and then we went into New York, and on the following day we stayed one night off the ship, and then the following day we boarded the ship and took off for Brazil. And I found, he appointed me as assistant director of this group on the reports that he made. And I discovered that what he meant by the assistant director was really the baggage master to take charge of the baggage equipment. So when we went to New York, I rode the baggage van that took the equipment down to New York and took care of getting it aboard ship. And
just a second, I've got to... Go ahead.
Oh. Cut that off a minute.
Okay.
So I went to Brown University and we set sail on board this Liberty ship, the old one. It had a cargo which included, I don't know, among other things, some cars on deck and so on. And we had accommodations for 12 people, and there were 8 of us in the party that went down there, and we got the whole 12 staterooms, Smiley did, for the group. So we didn't have any other passengers except just the group. And it was made a very nice thing. But going down, every day, morning and evening, we did continuous observations of the sun, plotting the positions and times of the sun as it sunk below the horizon.
Uh-huh.
And this was, we'd do it starting an hour before sunset, when the sun is 15 degrees high,
uh-huh.
and an hour after sunrise at 15 degrees high.
Uh-huh.
We did that going all the way down to Brazil from New York. And the man who was, I got acquainted with him because of my interest in navigation. I got acquainted with the first mate, second mate, who was the navigator
mm-hmm.
on board the ship. And he said this was the first time that he'd been on a ship where there's so many people that did navigation.
Uh-huh.
Because Smiley insisted we had we had sextants, of course, and used those. And we also had a clock that they carry on board ship mm-hmm. at that time, which kept accurate time so that we had the time and so on. And he said this was the first, and Smiley insisted that we do our own positioning.
Mm-hmm.
So before we'd take our observations in the evening and after we'd finish them up in the morning, we took sun observations
uh-huh.
to get our position on the ocean. And I'm sure that our records would show, I didn't see the records, of course, because he had them and turned them in. I'm sure our records would show that we were at least within a mile of where we said we were on the road down and back.
Yeah.
And we took observations morning, evening, and noon.
Mm-hmm.
There were three times that we did this sighting. And this navigator on board ship said this is more time than he'd ever seen before the ship was knew where it was. Of course, he knew. He was a good navigator. And so I enjoyed that trip very much, and went down to Brazil. On the day of the eclipse, I don't remember the exact date now, but it was in April sometime, the morning of the eclipse, we'd set up our equipment and we were all ready to do research on the eclipse. And in rolled a very heavy fog. We weren't too far from the ocean. We were in about 50 miles or so, but that wasn't far enough, apparently. And so the fog rolled in, and we didn't see the eclipse at all, but I enjoyed the trip very much. And the total cost to me was amazing, because I went down there and back and had all this fun with the group that went down. And also, we were treated royally in Brazil
mm-hmm.
because we were scientists from America, and we got to see things that the average tourist never would have been able to get to see
mm-hmm.
and visit people that they never would visit. Smiley did all the lecturing down there. He gave several lectures to the Brazilian people that understood English. He didn't know Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
I had picked up some Portuguese. I could tell say a few words in Portuguese, but my facility, fortunately, in German turned out to be useful, because one of the men who was in charge of our party, one of the Brazilians, was a German emigre, and of course he understood German perfectly, and he and I could converse in German.
Hmm.
And then he would translate to the workmen that we had in Portuguese, and I would translate back to Smiley what he told me. He didn't know any English. He would tell me in German, and I would translate back to Smiley in English. This is a rather funny situation, because we had the Portuguese workmen doing mm-hmm. work for us, setting up the equipment and mm-hmm. so on. A scientist down there wouldn't think of doing the work himself.
Mm-hmm.
You did it. You told what you wanted done, and then they did it.
Hmm.
And so we were all ready for the eclipse, but when it came over, it was clouded out.
There are
kind of, I think, ends up that Brazil story, and that's probably all that's necessary to give.
Okay.
If I were you, I'd cut off the page.